Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, September 17th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 187. That's a heavy number.
187? That's a big dog number.
Okay. That joke doesn't work because the thing that you're referencing...
Listen to the end of the episode.
It's a Snoop Dogg number, so I mean it's...
All right.
It's the number they gave him. So I'm your host, Austin Walker, and joining me in this very laughy intro of Waypoint Radio in the room, Danielle Riendo.
Hi, hello.
Hi. Also, big dog himself, Rob Zachney. Woof.
We got code 187 here. Looks like I should have stayed on the porch. Came down here and ran with the big dogs.
God damn it. Patrick Klepek, how are you doing? Look, are you some sort of dog also?
No, well, I'm the brother of a dog that Natalie enjoys very much.
Oh.
Socks?
Isabel.
Yeah.
Isabel.
Oh, this is actually super funny.
So, yeah, this weekend I went to a Chicago festival called Riot Fest, and I tweeted out that I was going there because I was going there in support of my brother and his band, who has largely disbanded in the years since. A lot of them hit their 30s, was doing a reunion show, which is like one of the things that Riot Fest does. Like, they'll get together groups from like 10 years ago and like play like their seminal album front to back or stuff like that. And so they've been offered a couple of years and finally got around to doing it this year. And so I just tweeted out that I was going to see the audition. Then this morning, like I guess Twitter's algorithm like surfaced it to Natalie. And then she realized that back in circa 2009, during her emo years, that she was like a super fan of my brother's band and didn't put together that I was the brother of Tim Klepek, was one of the guitarists in that band. And then we all witnessed what seemed like close to a meltdown morning as she like put this together. And then I started just like pasting photos and videos into chat, like of my brother, like with my daughter. And like
by the end of it, she was singing in the lobby. Yep. She was there playing, music.
I'm just so upset because if I had known this 24 hours ago, I would have gotten the band to make a very embarrassing video calling her out. But is not to be.
He's still
my brother, so I have a chance that I guess
one
if, if she's willing to settle for one of the audition, maybe I can still get that embarrassing video.
God, amazing. Unfortunately, Natalie isn't here right now. She's dealing with some moving. She's moving apartments, and that happens. And it turns out moving apartments means dealing with like landlords and roommates and
friends.
Keys. And friends who
unhelpful
visit.
Unhelpful friends.
I'm going to shout out Natalie's bad friend who got her locked out of her own damn apartment. I bring this up because Natalie actually gave me a letter to read regarding our first segment here today.
Oh.
And I'm gonna kick it off by reading this letter from Natalie.
Okay.
Dear Waypointers, unfortunately, my voice is unable to be on the podcast today. I hope that my words can suffice in its place. Last Thursday, something happened. There has been a tangible shift in the workings of the universe. A new world is upon us. The air there smells better. The flowers look brighter. Their fishes' scales are shinier. Their bugs hum prettier songs. Their fruit tastes sweeter. Public works projects come to fruition. A raccoon controls the better part of the economy. Animal Crossing is coming to the Switch in 2019. We have prayed. We have begged. And our pleas have finally been answered. In the year of our Isabel 2019, we will be returning to our beloved villages once again, yet this time anew. I find myself smiling more these days since the announcement. Life just feels a little better knowing that there is an Animal Crossing game on the horizon. I know you all must share my feelings of purest joy when thinking of our not too far off future. All my best. Natalie. Audition Lover 22, Watson.
Definitely a Yahoo account.
Uh-huh.
So at the end there, it's starting to sound like Natalie's starting a cult.
You know,
and she's like, already in one.
Isn't that how you would describe most Animal Crossing fans?
That's very true.
Called out.
We said there was a Nintendo Direct last week that ended on maybe the biggest troll I've seen Nintendo do.
It was good.
You were watching. You were live tweeting it.
I had a whole thread.
You did. What were your thoughts? Let's talk generally about the Nintendo Direct.
Well, the biggest theme,
yeah,
is that Luigi's dead again.
Is that the biggest theme?
Luigi is dead. Waluigi nowhere to be found.
It's also probably
and
dead.
And Isabelle
back.
Isabelle's back.
Thank God.
So we've got like a switching of the guard
here. The death
and
return of Isabelle.
Basically, like, you know,
right.
Different Nintendo characters are back in or back out, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. You know, various things are happening. Luigi is dead, though.
Right, because it was the first thing they opened with.
They started with Luigi's Mansion 3, a teaser, like a very, very
short
teaser.
So I missed that. I missed that because I came in right after that. What was that? What's that look like? Was that gameplay footage? What was that?
No, it was definitely like a CG, very, very short teaser. It was maybe 30 seconds long, maybe a tiny bit more.
Just doing Luigi shit?
Don't quote me on exactly how long, but yeah. He kind of comes in the door, and you can see he's in a creepy mansion again. Okay. He's kind of looking around, being scared.
There's ghosts.
He appears to be alive in this.
Okay.
Now, the real science here, what I really want the real scientists to come in on, is whether or not he's dead, because in the Luigi's Mansion remake, which is also coming out soon, the remake for the Nintendo DS,
yeah.
There is a two-player mode where the second player can play as Ghost Luigi, which means he's dead.
Well, he got killed earlier this year, remember,
exactly.
From that, what was it, was Ridley? No, who, oh, it
yeah.
was like, the,
yeah,
it was
Ridley.
Death. No, it was Death, it was Death,
oh,
it was a different
right.
Animal
That's
Crossing
right.
thing. Got death killed. So that's when it's just a timeline. So maybe Luigi Mansion 3 is a prequel.
Oh, it might be.
Before Luigi gets killed by Death in Smash Brothers.
But then he's both dead and alive in the remake of Luigi's Mansion.
So was that also announced?
Single
or was
player
that?
And double, yeah, so, that was announced. Like, details about Luigi's Mansion, the remake
which
for the DS.
Has a two-player mode.
That's right.
In which one of you plays as Luigi's ghost.
Yeah, a green ghost.
Maybe it's just a green ghost that looks like Luigi. Maybe it's a different ghost.
I mean, that's possible.
How
or
many,
it's a Luigi from another time.
Have any of you ever dealt with ghosts? Have you ever fought a ghost before?
In real life?
No, but last night my wife was walking our dog, and apparently she looked over at her arm, and she saw the biggest spider she has ever seen just hanging out on her arm.
Fuck
and so
that.
And this is 10 p.m. at night. She screamed as though she was being like murdered.
Attacked. Murdered
right.
by
attacked.
This spider. Yeah.
And she's not afraid of spiders, but she was like, this was not a spider, this was a cat, this was a spider.
Right.
And someone actually came out like running to like make sure she was okay.
Wow.
And
was,
nice.
And was like, do you want a glass of water? Do you need to sit down? And she was like, no, it was a that's nice. It was just a, it was a spider. It was a spider.
That's
and
very
then she,
funny.
She came
did
home
she, like, just,
close.
Like, shake it off of her? What'd she do?
She, like, literally just, like, the way it was described to me, because I was not with her, was, like, spasm. Like, your body just revolted in a way, probably
like,
not unlike what you would do if, like, you encountered, like, what would you actually do if you saw a ghost?
Ah!
Like, right. And that's what her body
ghost!
Did.
Get off of me.
Right.
Yeah.
But they like made the miscalculation of not knowing where the like tracking where the spider went.
That's the problem.
Then having to just like sprint away and just
fuck that.
So
fuck that.
Far
we have
away.
A useful scale here. You have a very small dog.
Yeah.
Pixel's a wee dog. Mm-hmm. How big was the spider in relation to the dog?
Well, I think it was more along the lines of like the kind of spiders you normally encounter in the Midwest, which is like the you're usually like big spiders, like a daddy long legs, you know, like the with the
okay.
really
yeah.
long.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's like the. You know, you'll see smaller spiders, but, like, that's, like, the biggest you're going to see. The way she described this was, like, day long length barely even looks like a spider, honestly.
Yeah,
that's
the thing.
Mosquito.
It looks more like an insect or a, you know,
yeah.
to
yeah,
be
yeah,
more
yeah.
General. You don't necessarily look at it and go, spider. She
right.
said you looked at this and went, motherfucker, that's a spider.
Oh,
and
that's the worst.
That's bad.
I hate it. I hate it.
What if it was
it.
Just a noble orb weaver? Heavy with eggs.
I hate this. You're gonna stop talking.
It's their
talking.
Magnum opus.
I hate this.
Right?
Why? Kirby's Epic Yarn is also coming to 3DS.
I'm excited about that.
I'm just moving on. Yarns have three. Or Kirby, the greatest orb weaver of them all.
True. The truth. That game is adorable.
So
and
that
good,
was out on
the
Wii U. That is now coming to 3DS.
It was actually out on
was
the
out
Wii.
On Wii. That was a Wii.
That was
one.
Almost 10 years
Yoshi,
ago. That was 2009.
Yoshi Yarn something was Wii U.
Yoshi's Epic Yarn.
Yes,
yeah.
correct.
That's right.
Okay.
And okay. Also 3DS.
Jesus, was Epic Yarn really like a decade ago?
Epic Yarn was 2009. Yeah, almost a decade ago.
Cool.
Yeah, right? It's a good and cute game, so whatever.
Lots of 3DS stuff, actually, at this event, because there was also Bowser's Inside Story with Bowser Jr.'s journey or something.
Yes.
Right? I didn't play these. Do you know?
They're all like ports, them. Right? That's pretty basically what the 3DS is now, is like they're just kind of dumping like easy to shovel sort of stuff on there, where it seems like the biggest stuff is like, for a while I thought maybe they would try and straddle both, like you'd get like versions on 3DS and Switch. It seems like the Switch has been successful enough that they said, like actually what we should do is just put like for example, like the, you know, like the new Game Freak game, Town, isn't that with like the temporary name?
Is that Game Freak?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's being kind of looked at as like, oh, is cool. This like if you're wondering what Pokemon is going to look like next year, like this is probably like a pretty good sign of like the kind of game you should expect. Right. But that's the kind of game you would think like, oh, Game Freak, like the folks who do Pokemon, like they should probably put that on both platforms, right? And it's like, ah, well, actually, they're just putting it on Switch, or at least that's all they've announced. And so that makes me happy, because I'd rather they focus their efforts. I'd like to see, you know, the Switch versions be the best versions they can. But
totally.
And even these ports, like, I would play Epic Yarn again. I would play Luigi's Mansion 1, or at least I would I would pay like $15 to like just have it archived on my Switch. You know what I mean? Like,
honestly,
I look at my Switch as like, I'm whatever happens in the next 10 years, like there's going to be a consistency with that library that I feel for the first time in a long time okay paying for some older games just to have easy access to them and the portability. But like, this, what world am I going to go open up my 3DS to play Luigi's Mansion, which is like a game I like a lot.
Yeah.
I didn't like the second one very much, but I like the first one
a
lot.
And you're not going to replay it on 3DS, probably. No.
I would like, if I got a code, I would like open it up, play a level, and then like go back to forgetting where my charger
was.
Is
that the sound ghosts make when they get
spider ghosts?
Yeah.
Definitely.
That's bad. Spider ghosts sound like the worst.
That's bad. That's
at least
bad.
A spider I can get away from, or
spider ghost goes through walls.
Way.
It can climb on walls and go through them.
And also spider walk on your ghosts. Face, but you can't get it off your face.
Rob. Spider ghost is also the surest sign that your DM has completely run out of ideas.
Coming through the door, you see a spider ghost.
It has 8 legs, and you can count them all because you can see through the front legs because they're ghosts. You can see the back ones.
Whoa.
Is it making web or ectoplasm?
Both.
Spider ghost. It also
anyway, roll for initiative.
Yeah, exactly. God. AC-15. What else? What else stuck out to you, Danielle? Anything? You did a big live tweet thread.
I have my tweet thread here, which was very special to me. There was a Splatoon 2 extra content. I didn't pay that much attention to it because I was so shocked by the idea of Peachette, which is...
that was part of what? New Super Mario Brothers
U?
Yes,
there's New Super Mario Brothers U subtitle.
Yeah, it was the Wii U one.
Deluxe?
People like I didn't, for whatever reason, not buy it. I played a lot of new Super Mario Brothers on the Wii. Really enjoyed that. I played it as like a 4-player game, like front to back, and like had a great time with it. But apparently, like from folks I trust on platformers, they say the Wii U one is like deeply underrated as like a A+ platformer for that style of platformer that has gotten overlooked a lot because the aesthetic sucks. Yeah. Like, it does not, it's not enjoyable to look at in any way, but apparently it's a well-made platformer.
That's what it's just like, wah.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah, it's the worst.
They all sing.
And yeah, it's just like, it has such like a, like, there's nothing distinct about it in a way that like I can wrap up what the aesthetic vibe is of that game.
Nope.
But I hear the level design's great. It's out in January. So, you know, just in case you wanted to sneak in some more games during a not so busy time of the year.
Good.
The winter...
I'm happy to have another Mario platformer on the go,
sure,
though.
Like, sure, that's
because,
great.
You know, there's not going to be, whatever is the follow-up to Odyssey is, you know, years away. And so to have something like that, especially one that like it didn't put a lot of time into, and that's also the version they put out. This began the year of Luigi, I believe, was
exactly.
in the midst
of
this
Luigi update to it,
which is like brand new levels, like, so like that package is probably going to be like pretty compelling as far
and also Peachette.
So what's up with Peachette?
I think what happened is that Peach and Toadette had a baby through some sort of like fungi reproduction.
There was a fungi involved.
Well, there might have been.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I need to look into this. Again, the Mario scientists, Super Mario Broth can help me out a little bit.
Yeah, I guess speaking of Mario, Danielle shouting out Super Mario Broth. Supper Mario Broth, which is a very fun Mario fan blog filled with like incredible Mario facts that Patrick, you just did an interview with the person who runs it.
It's up on the site now. I did a profile on well, he asked me to refer to him as Broth. I can't tell you any more than that. I was like, hey, do for the purposes of me talking to you in this conversation, do you want to tell me your name and I'll just leave it out of the article? And instead it was, for the purposes of this conversation, you can call me Broth. And
it's like, very
okay.
Good.
I like that a lot.
But yeah, it's a Tumblr and Twitter account that has just thousands upon thousands of just like very meticulous research, trivia, images, GIFs, like just it runs the gamut on if you're in, even if you're not really into Mario, like it's just fascinating as a deep dive. The reason I stumbled onto writing about him was because his power was going to go out. He doesn't have a lot of money, right. And he literally was paying for internet in data chunks at a time, which meant he was doing a lot of work offline and then strategically figuring out what he was using his time. Anyway, so he opened up a Patreon and as a result has gone from he likes his privacy, likes being anonymous, but in order to have a Patreon, you sort of have to break down that barrier a little bit. And so we chatted about a bunch of that stuff on a story that's on the site.
Any details from Super Mario Broth about Nabbit or Toadette or Peachette, who are the new characters in Super Mario Bros. U Deluxe?
I mean, one of the things that he does do is that when these announcements happen, he goes through and kind of helps explain some of Nintendo's thinking. Like, I think he has explained or found the explanation for, like, why there's, like, a mushroom that you grab in the Switch Super Mario Bros. U that, like, turns – I don't know. He's got some tidbits already about the stuff
he's
going to announce
some science
on this direct.
On it. Good.
Yeah.
I guess those are the two characters. Nabbit. So you can play as already in that game. You could play as Luigi, Mario, Toad, and Toadette, right?
Right.
Or maybe Toadette is new. One of the new ones is Nabbit.
Nabbit.
Who is?
That's right.
Is Nabbit from something? Nabbit just looks like a rabbit to me.
Is that the one from Link Between Worlds? Is that who Nabbit is?
It might be. Nabbit definitely rings a bell. I might need a Super Mario helper. A Broth helper.
From Luigi U, it looks like. Was in New Super Mario Brothers U, robbing toad houses. And
Nabbit
was,
looks kind of like an evil clown rabbit.
Yeah, right? It's like a rabbit with like a bandana on its face.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. It looks a little evil.
It does. Well, and the good news is
its teeth are bigger than anything else.
Nabbit can run around without touching anything. Nabbit
cool.
is like a really – I love this as like a mode for – like a like an added difficulty mode. Of just
like the funky mode.
Yeah, exactly. I love that stuff. I love that it's like kind of diegetic and that like, oh yeah, we're not just going to like make it so that Mario doesn't – like Mario gets hit by things, but Nabbit doesn't. Mm-hmm. And like that's a fun way to make games a little more accessible. Toadette, who can get this special like crown mushroom or something – and okay. turn into Peach.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
There's a
That's
lot going
the one
on.
that he explains. So if you go back to the Super Mario Bros. There, he found like a – not like a mythos explanation, but like a logical explanation for how Nintendo has handled some of that stuff in the past, I believe.
Gotcha.
Peachette was the one that
– spoke to you.
Spoke to me, you know, personally as the child, the love child of Peach and Toadette.
She's like she has like a regular Peach dress on, but it has like kind of Toad style spots on it.
Yes,
and also she has like a toad head inside
she's
of the crown.
She's half human, half mushroom.
Half mushroom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm down.
Yeah,
you know?
It's pretty cool.
Good for her.
And then my next note was Katamari Switch.
Oh right,
Katamari Switch.
What's the actual name of that? That has like a.
It's like re.
It should be
don't
like re-rolled.
It. Yes, it's like re-rolled or something like that.
It is. It is re-rolled.
It is re-rolled.
Katamari
okay.
Damacy re-rolled is out this winter. I'm just happy that like that's on Switch. That feels like such a natural fit to me in terms of like vibe and attitude and like style.
And the original is still good. They never got anywhere close to capturing right. the magic of the original and the sequels, which ranged from fine to okay, mm-hmm. but it was sort of the definition of a game that probably, like, no publisher is going to contain themselves, but in the sequels proved that it was a one-off that just should have been that thing.
Yeah.
And I'm just glad that that is the kind of game that when I think about what would I go back and pay, you know, $20 for or $30 for?
Just to have.
Like, that is a game that it has been long enough that, yes, I would love to. Even I only played it for an hour. Like, that would be enough for me to have that game portable. That's just a really nice. Those are the kinds of. I hope we're getting a lot more. If that's what's going to pad between, like, the big Nintendo releases,
yeah.
It's like more games like that would be appreciated.
Totally.
I've actually never played it.
It's,
I mean, I know the whole.
I bet it holds up.
I bet, like, just
especially
I mean,
that you soundtrack.
Liked, you liked Donut County, right?
Loved it.
Yeah, I bet you loved Katamari.
Yeah.
There are arguments to be made that, Donut County owes a lot to Katamari.
Yeah.
This just in. Shout out to Kato for putting this across our desks. This comes in from Mario Broth blog on Twitter.
Oh, good.
Toadette's transformation into Peachette upon collecting a crown in New Super Mario Bros. U Deluxe may be a reference to Yoshi's ability to transform into Mario, Luigi, and Wario by picking up their hats in Super Mario 64 DS. And then there's a screenshot here from the instruction manual that says, by wearing a cap, Yoshi can turn into Mario, Luigi, or Wario. When he does, he can perform any of that character's unique moves. And then a similar screenshot from Super Mario 64, Super Mario Bros. Brothers U
Deluxe.
New Super Mario Brothers U Deluxe.
Yes.
Here's what I love is there's a follow-up from a fan who says, wow, you're quick, but are you sure this post is compliant to your veracity policy? and Super Mario Broth says, yes, as I merely point out that the concepts on display are very similar and have never been done in other Mario series games, and so there's a possibility of it being a reference. If I said is a reference instead of may be a reference, that would be undue speculation. And the fan says, I understand. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, so, well, one of the things I explore in my profile is one of the things I wanted to answer for myself was whether, like, is the meticulousness, is that language a bit? Like, is that someone, like, you know, putting on their monocle and, like, being kind of funny? And, like, no, like, 100% that is not a bit. That is, like, this person takes this deeply seriously. It's, like, incredibly important to them. And, yes, it definitely comes across as funny. Like, I laugh at that. Like, that exchange is hilarious. But it is definitely not – it is not coming for laughs from Mr. Broth.
Gotcha.
Shout out to the Broth.
Gotcha. Thank you, Broth.
Thank you, Broth.
Love soup.
What else? Switch Online. So Nintendo – what's the actual name of that service? Is it just the Nintendo Online service?
I don't know. I'm not going to pay for it, so.
It is going to cost you $3.99 a month, $7.99 for 3 months, or $20, $19.99.
And there's like a family pack.
There is a family pack. It lets you do cloud saves for most games, but not
most
all games.
Online games, which is like especially funny with Splatoon, which is not going to support it because it's like, wow. It's awesome to buy a game and then 6 months later have to pay for the online to play that game. Not a good look. You should have just exempted that game and said, going forward, new release. Especially when you have things like Fortnite, which will not require the online service.
Oh, really? Because it's a free game? Is that why?
It's a free-to-play. But I believe on PSN, you need PlayStation Plus to play free. I might be getting this wrong, but I think you might be wrong. Are all of them?
It's an Epic account, isn't it?
On PS4, anything that's free to play does not need need PS Plus. I'm pretty sure. I'm wrong here, but I'm pretty sure that's the case.
Either way, it's still silly to charge money for a game that has been out for 6 months where you haven't paid.
Totally.
Like, explain that to your kid.
Yeah.
Right. So what comes with this new service is. The cloud saving, which again, except for some online games like Splatoon 2, also Dark Souls Remastered won't have it, which is because it's online. I guess. Yeah, great. Or FIFA 19. So yeah, I guess online games, which is like, but those
you know,
games,
other every other platform for these games, like it's not like if it's women, it was like Splatoon 2. Maybe Nintendo just I don't know they're behind the eight ball on this stuff because they often are, but. Like Dark Souls Remastered is on three other platforms.
That sucks.
Well, you don't have cloud saves on a PS4 account generally either.
Right, but I'm saying, but if you have PS4, if you have PS Plus, you do. That's one of the things you
get
with PS Plus.
But like, it is the service, their service.
This is you don't get it, period.
With the service, you don't get it with Dark Souls.
That is bananas.
They're saying like because it's an online game, because it will allow cheating. And I'll be clear, it does allow cheating. I use it to cheat. Black Dynamite, we sell drugs in the community. There are definitely times. In fact, I had to do it. Where did I have to do it? There was a game recently that had two endings. And I'm so thankful that I...
Far Cry. Right?
Yeah. There you Far go. Cry 5, before launch, it had a bug where if you chose one of the two endings, it would just loop
you.
It locked you in, and you could never go back and play the game again. And so I was stuck in that ending. But thankfully, I'd uploaded a cloud save to PS Plus so that I could download it and go back in. Like, yeah, you could totally do that to keep your record or whatever, or to keep your items from breaking in Dark Souls or whatever. But let me fucking... I don't care. Let me
you
upload
paid
my
for
fucking...
the damn service.
Or those games should have client-side cloud saves, like, built in on their side so that I can... Be like, yeah, here's my ticket. Here's my, like, validation. Let me download my save if I get a new Switch. Right. Whatever.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, and the online stuff on Switch bothers me. I mean, I think some basic level of, like, cloud service should just be part of buying a console.
Yeah.
And Switch is particularly egregious because there is no easy way to back up local saves.
Right.
So
right.
On the Xbox and the PlayStation, if you don't want to – well, Xbox cloud saves are just part of buying the console, that you don't need to have gold to have it. Once you have Xbox Live, you get cloud saves. I mean, they run – was it Azure, whatever their online service. Like, you know, they have an infrastructure there. You pay for it on PlayStation. But at least on both those platforms, you can easily do your own backups if, like, say, every 6 months, I'm just going to back up all my saves. You cannot – do that on Switch, and I think it is bullshit that there isn't some sort of recovery process for you if you're I mean, $20 is fairly reasonable as far as these things go.
Because
who doesn't want to pay $20 a year to get the right to pay $80 for some Nintendo ass Joy-Cons? You have to be a member of that service.
Yeah.
Oh, now, yep.
What a privilege. What a right to be a consumer.
Gamer Nation, rise up. The Switch is getting new NES-style controllers, says Kirk Hamilton over at Kotaku.
They are cute.
They look dope, you said?
They are really cute.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to pay for that online service, and I'm certainly not going
to
pay $80
those,
for a Joy-Con.
If you have to be a member of the Nintendo online service. You have to be part of Mario's Posse.
That's
Posse
what it's
up.
Really called.
It's a big dog t-shirt.
Posse up, gamers.
But it's Mario crossing his arms, and his hat is tilted off to one side. And
if I was paying $20 to become part of Mario's Posse, I would pay the $20.
And he says, "Posse up, gamers! It's me, Mario. Posse up!" and you could buy these NES style controllers. They just look like NES controllers. And the reason that's important, I guess, is another part of the clouds or the Nintendo Online service is access to what they're saying will be an expanding library of classic games. It's starting with 20 games on service, I believe, including like Tecmo Bowl and Super Mario Brothers and Donkey Kong.
They should have just put NES Remix as the thing because that is a much friendlier way of learning about those games and playing those games. And they're good and they're from several years ago.
I am glad that you are just getting, okay, here's some games. Like, I'm happy, like, the Remix didn't let you just play the raw ass game, right? It's like,
no, I don't think so.
Yeah. Other stuff on there, Dr. Mario, it looks like, Balloon Fight, Zelda, Legend of Zelda, here we go, launch titles, I got it. Tennis, Soccer,
mm-hmm.
Donkey Kong, Mario yep. Brothers, mm-hmm. Super Mario Brothers, mm-hmm. Balloon Fight, Ice Climber, Dr. Mario, The Legend of Zelda, Super Mario Brothers 3, Double Dragon, River City Ransom, Ghosts and Goblins, Tecmo Bowl, not Tecmo Super Bowl, which is a mistake. Gradius, Pro Wrestling, Excite Bike, Yoshi, a game that very few people have played.
Yoshi.
Ice Hockey.
That's the puzzle game,
that's
right?
That's the puzzle game, yeah. Yeah.
With like cookies?
With cookies. Oh, no, that might be Yoshi's Cookie.
Yoshi's Cookies.
Yoshi's Cookie is a different game.
Might be separate from Yoshi.
Yeah, Yoshi is its own game. Separate game.
Okay.
I believe. That's fine. These are all things you can...
Do you have the NES Classic? Because you have most of these.
Like, do you have the internet? Because you have most of these.
Yeah. Do you have Nesticle?
Haven't you bought all of these, like, 800 times before?
Yeah.
And I get it. Like, I want that... If that service was 200 games, I'd be like, oh, hell yeah.
And had N64 library, SNES library, you know.
Just start dipping in that...
Yeah.
Talk to me in
games.
A year, basically.
Yeah, I want Super Mario Sunshine. I want to play Super Mario Sunshine.
They don't
want
to give that. See, that's the thing with me. Test of the service.
Are they going to HD remix that one? $30.
Yeah, yeah, of course, of course. Yeah,
that would be fine. I want to play it again.
if they went through and like cleaned it up and like gave you like proper control, I would
like
pay
Wind
for that.
Wind Waker HD style.
Right. Some other stuff from this. Game Freak's working on Town, which we mentioned, which is like an RPG, like an action RPG looking thing that all takes place in one town. That looks cute.
Yeah,
I'm down. City Skyline is apparently
down
out
for town.
On Switch.
It's kind of great.
Which is cool. I haven't seen how that looks or how that plays. I know one person who plays lots of City Skylines. Well, they're not on Twitter anymore.
Not on Twitter. He left Twitter.
So Nick Capizzoli left Twitter. I'm not getting my City Skylines fixed.
We skipped over something very important, Austin.
What did I skip over?
There was a Mario Party.
Oh, did I skip that?
But don't worry about it, because the really important thing was the fact that Diablo was announced for the Switch, and it was announced with the fervor and good cheer of a Nintendo announcer man saying something along the lines of, like, blew down the doors of hell, and like it was very good.
Is Nintendo allowed to say hell?
That's the thing. The dude said it. He was like, gather your friends and blow down the doors to hell. I'm paraphrasing, but it was along those lines, and he definitely said something about that.
Can we just
fury
get
of
Reggie,
hell.
Right. Can we get Reggie saying, stay a while and listen? Like, we get like
the same
with
voice.
The same voice, yeah.
It was beautiful.
God. That's out. Is that out this year or next year?
Mm-hmm.
This year? This year.
I'm curious about that. I never played any of the Diablo 3 DLC. I never played it on a console, and I hear that was a really fun way to play those games. Civ 6 also coming to Switch later this year, November, which is interesting. I didn't put enough time into Civ 6, and it's fascinating to me to think about playing those games on console or on Switch specifically. Rob, you look like you have some deep thoughts here.
I mean, I'm just like genuinely, I'm really curious how it's going to perform. Cause like Civ 6 on my PC isn't amazing. Like, especially every Civ game toward the end game, it begins to really demonstrate like how CPU locked are you basically? Yeah. How's your hardware? So I'm really curious how this is going to play. But that being said, if they manage to make this work and work smoothly, that would probably get me back into Civ in a lot of ways. Because if I'm in like desktop mode, like there's a lot of other games now that I generally like prefer to play instead of Civ, but like Civ on the go.
Civ in the car. Don't play Civ behind
Civ
the wheel.
Civ in the car.
Don't do
There's
it.
There's a lot of people who, like, for years argued that, like, Civ Rev was quietly one of the best ways to play Civ. Like, hands down. And I'm curious if this will bring about sort of a renaissance for Civ 6.
Yeah, that could be really interesting. And just generally anytime, as someone who likes strategy games, but who sometimes has a hard time getting people into them, I love whenever there's a new thing I can point to be like, hey, try this. I really liked Civ Revolution for that, actually, years ago. I was just like, hey, this will give you the gist of why I like these things. So I'm very curious to see how that thing plays.
Yeah.
Hey, do you like Final Fantasy?
Yeah, Final Fantasy VIII.
Well, I got bad news for you.
And only
shit.
You.
There was that great meme going around that was the, like,
give Squall a chance.
Not that one. That one's good, too. The one that's just, like, the nine-box grid of all the Final Fantasies are just, like, all your favorite Final Fantasies are coming to Switch. You. Not you. You. It's a World Final Fantasy, which was which I thought was already out on Switch, but that fucking shows me I'm not paying close enough attention. Final Fantasy XII Zodiac Age is coming to Switch next year. The 7, 9, 10, and 10-2 remasters are all coming to Switch next year. Lots of Final Fantasy. Lots of it. And
8's good. 8's the best.
Rob, you sent me down a fucking rabbit hole. I read a page. I read a whole long thing. I didn't tell you this. But I'm going to just say the name of this thing. Squallisdead.com. Really quick. I said that.
I forgot about that theory.
There is an ableist slur at like the very end of this page. I absolutely read, 3,000 words before this fucker dropped the R word, but like she fucking sure did. So just heads up about that going to squallisdead.com. But boy, I read that whole theory.
Oof.
Rob, you led me there because of a tweet. You want to talk about this?
Yeah, look, I understand people not digging 8, but I think 8 becomes a really interesting game if you begin to just, like, open your heart and your mind to the possibility that the things that don't quite seem to work, the weird shifts in relationships, and, like, the weird unsettling ending in which something just feels off about all the characters celebrating and, like, Squall isn't there, but then he is in the very final shot, but there's been no evidence of him existing in the happy reality of the rest of the victorious heroes in the final cutscene. Yeah. And all of it begins to make a lot more sense if you assume that one way or another, the main character Squall does not make it to the end of that game.
Right.
Now, me personally... Like
Yeah, he's the Luigi of Final Fantasy VIII.
Okay.
Now, me personally, I always believed that Squall died, like, later in the game.
Buy the ice shard theory.
I don't, but the ice shard theory is really compelling. It's that... Because
Final Fantasy... He gets shot in the chest with a big ice shard! It's, like, through his whole body!
And shakes it off. Medically...
You know
that
this.
That will often kill a person.
Often. All the time.
And but once the ice melts, you're fine.
That's it.
You're fine. No. But that's exactly it. And, like, the other weird thing is, after the moment of his death, all his relationships are a little bit different. Like, the plot, like, is redirected, and the groundwork that was laid in the first act isn't really relevant anymore. Like, different... Like, the game is moving in a different direction. And... I think the game becomes way more interesting if you view the entire game as kind of a Lost-style purgatory in which characters are forced to confront both their regrets and the things about themselves that remain mysterious and have to resolve the inner tensions of the character and find peace and resolution with their regrets
those
and their
desires.
Flaws.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this amazing shot of Squall without a face.
Oh!
It's too much.
Squall without a face.
Okay. Yeah, look, bring it up, Kato, so that
might
Danielle,
need to see it.
You can just it's scary, and that's just in the ending. That's
wow!
just no, I got it. It's just right there. Yeah.
Wow.
That's dead. He's dead. He doesn't have a face.
That's not even not a face.
Yeah,
that is a black hole in a skull.
Yeah,
where a face should be.
I had
Squall hair over it.
Yeah, exactly. I had not finished this game ever. I played Final Fantasy VIII, but I never finished it. And so I watched all of the ending of that game. That's creepy.
Do you think Squall is alive at the end of that game? Do you think he lives through that game? Me either. I don't think there's any, like, and apparently, like, this theory has been put to the creator, and they're like, haha, funny fan theory. He, you know, of course he's alive. I'm like...
Don't trust creators.
Ain't the fucking game I played.
Is he alive or is he undead?
I tell stories every day. I lie constantly. People go, hey, Austin, what about Blob? No, I'm not telling you that. You know, that's... Have you seen my pin tweet ever? It's that David Lynch quote?
Yes.
Laughs does not answer.
Yeah, laughs does not answer. Yeah, exactly.
Good.
All right, well, Final Fantasy VIII was not at the Nintendo Direct. Wait.
If Squall wasn't dead before, he sure shit is now. Because Nintendo came up and put 2 in the chest.
The second ice shard. Reggie just
walked
up.
What are they going to do later? Just like a year from now, be like, and now Final Fantasy VIII coming to the Switch. Like, this was its moment. If it's coming, there's some speculation that maybe there's some hang-up because that game... prominently features this song "Eyes on Me," which is like a huge marketing and like a huge. It's a huge cutscene, and it's by like a very prominent Japanese musician, and that maybe that is related to because Japanese music licensing is a fucking thing.
What
so,
if a year from now we get a Nintendo Direct and we get an image of an astronaut floating in space? And it's just, like, from the side. It's, like, a side angle shot. You know, it's, like, a wide shot. So the astronaut's body floating in space. And then it turns. And the glass shatters. And it reveals it's Squall's face. And you're like, oh, they're bringing Final Fantasy VIII finally to the Switch. And then it says, Squall arrives. You know, the seed has sprouted. And Squall arrives in Smash Brothers Ultimate.
Oh, my God.
And they bring him to Smash. Because that's basically what it looked like they were doing with Isabelle from Animal Crossing New Leaf. They did this whole long-running, like, CG cutscene of Isabelle, like, going about her chores in the mayor's office. Isabelle's a very cute dog from Animal Crossing New Leaf, a game I have a lot of fondness for it, even though also I wish it had let me be a person of color without having taken on an intense tanning regimen, which you can read about if you search for me in the screen, Austin Walker. But it turned out Isabel in Smash, coming to Smash. And I think the entire internet who cares about Animal Crossing, and I know a lot of people don't like Animal Crossing. Shout out to people who don't like Animal Crossing. I know you like other stuff. That's cool. For those of us who enjoy Animal Crossing, this felt like a betrayal. But it also felt too cruel for Nintendo.
Yeah.
I could feel the same Nintendo who teased Ridley earlier this year and gave people Ridley in Smash Brothers was certain to come back around and give us a new Animal Crossing. And so finally, we got this screen of a hollow-eyed Tom Nook staring at a screen until finally Animal Crossing 2019 appeared on the screen.
Yeah.
Do you qualify his eyes as hollow?
Kind of like Squall's face.
Basically Squall's face. Listen, I'm not – we can't get into the Nook course.
The Nook course.
We don't have the time. It's so much. Rob, it's –
Look forward to Waypoint's new podcast, only focused on Tom Nook.
Is there anything to be said about Tom Nook that I can't get just by listening to Jolly Banker?
No. You know, there's a lot of various takes out there on Twitter. Do yourself a favor and at this point, eject is what I would say. Eject. There are some fun threads out there, but it was a lot. I felt like I was surrounded by discourse minds. And there was no safe. The only way to win is not to play Animal Crossing 2019. That's a Nintendo Direct. Anything else? There was one last thing I do want to shout out. There's like a Capcom beat 'em up bundle that now comes out fairly soon. And I love the idea of those being bundled. That makes sense. That's like whatever that King Arthur one was, is in there.
Shit. I loved that
game.
Yeah,
me too. 100%. So much that I can't quite remember the name of it. So Knights of the Round? Knights of the Round. So that's like Knights of the Round, Final Fight. There's a bunch of them in there. I want to say there's like four or six in this bundle.
The Switch is also the world where I would even...
Yes.
I played a lot of beat-em-ups in the SNES area, but it's not a genre that, like, I maintained a fondness for. I felt like at some point video games sort of passed that genre by.
Yes.
And, like, the idea of, like, sitting down on, like, my big-ass TV and, like, I'm going to play Final Fight. Like, outside the realm of, like, playing with some friends where we're just, like, goofing around and being nostalgic, like, there's just no world I want to play those games ever again. But the idea of, like, oh, like, I've got 15 minutes on this train. Like, I'll bust through some stages. Like, 100%. That sounds good.
Especially as like a big single purchase, it's so much easier for me to be like, yeah, these 7 beat 'em ups are
how much
worth? You know, I don't remember, and my computer is fighting me.
Okay,
you have a computer. Someone else could look this up.
How much would you pay? Here's well,
ooh, depends on what's in there.
I would pay. Oh, okay. All right. So you don't know the whole lineup.
Not off my head. I'm trying to get it to load, and it's okay. I think I have the lineup. Okay. Final Fight. King of the Dragons, which is like a fantasy one that I didn't play. This is a bad one for me. Like you can't ask me this question actually, because there is a game with giant robots in it that never came out in America, and I only played it once.
Oh, it's got Captain Commando. That's like my favorite beat 'em up of all time.
It does have Captain Commando in it. There's a game called. Is it just? What is it called? It's something robot.
Two unreleased games? Armored Warriors?
Warriors. I played in the bar in Jersey City once, and I beat it because it was on free play.
$20. Perfect.
That's it. That's the number.
That's the price.
Oh.
That's the price.
And that's
$25 would have been too much. $25 would have been too much.
Too much. But Final Fight, Captain Commando, Battle Circuit, which I've not played, Knights of the Round, King of the Dragons, Armored Warriors, that was it called?
That's one of them listed here, yeah.
And I'm missing one. What's the one I'm missing? Warriors of Fate. I have no idea what that is. Probably also never came out here. $20. That's the right online play.
And people it comes pointing out some of the ones. AVP, also one of my favorite beat-em-ups of all
AVP
time.
AVP is a great game. Aliens vs. Predator, have you ever played that?
I have not, but I want to cut a video.
The art in that game is so good.
It makes me want that anime. It makes me want the Alien vs. Predator anime, which doesn't exist as far as I know, but that's in that world because it's just like so fucking cool.
You can use those sprites.
Right, exactly. That's exactly. Yeah. At least those character designs. So,
dang.
Awesome. What else? Anything else from the board games, which is actually one of them. A couple of them are super interesting. Munchkin is getting a game. Catan, obviously, unsurprisingly. Carcassonne, Pandemic, and the Lord of the Rings, the Living Card Game are all getting Switch
which
releases.
Looks like Hearthstone, basically, right?
I have no idea what the mechanics are, and I'm like a weird card game player, so
okay.
I don't think many physical card games look like Hearthstone because it's so weird. But what's important there is that that's a Fantasy Flight game. I mean, I guess it's not important anymore because
you were living in a reality where like Netrunner on Switch. For a heartbeat there, and you just remembered that it's not, you can't happen now, and you got sad.
I genuinely want you to know I want to cry. Oh. Like, I genuinely am not happy about this. Oh. I've been looking at eBay for complete Netrunner collections. I almost bid on one for like $550 the other day.
See, anyway. I've been sort of toying around with like, hey, I should get the starter set they put out. And I'm like, what's the point now? What's the point?
It's a great game. It's a great game. It's a great game to own. I want to own all of it.
You can play it with your friends.
There are ways to play it online for free through services and stuff that I don't feel bad about now because
feel less bad in a few months.
Exactly, exactly. Speaking of board games, I think that's probably it. But really quick before we go to break, Rob, you played a game called Mask of the Red Death.
Yeah.
Over the weekend? Tell me about that before we take a quick break.
This
is based on the Edgar Allan Poe short story?
It sure is.
Good.
Oh, word. Good. Okay.
So it's an odd little board game. It's very cute, almost like Gory-esque in its art.
Okay.
And basically it's... So if you know the story, it's a bunch of, nobles and well-to-do people trying to ride out some sort of, plague, and they've all sort of holed up, and it's obviously heavy with metaphor. It's all the upper class swells deciding that while the rest of the world's like dying of plague, they're gonna throw a big fucking party, and they're gonna ride it out that way. And then at midnight, the mysterious guest who's been at the ball the entire takes off the mask, and it's the Red Death, and it's been there at the party the whole time, and everyone dies. So this game starts like you are one of the party goers, and there's two things you're trying to do. One is you try to curry favor with and popularity, and so you impress people with your witticisms and your dance moves, and you go and flatter the Prince Prospero.
Right.
But you do all this by playing cards from your hand. But the main thing you're going to do is discuss rumors. And that's how you get information about what's going to happen at midnight.
What's your favorite track on Rumors?
But the thing is, like, both the flaw and the – not the flaw. The whole point of the game that can make it a little inaccessible but also, like, something you can get a little obsessed over is that – so whoever's still alive at 1 a.m. is who's going to win the game. Odds of it being more than one person, pretty poor.
Sure.
And death is going to be stalking through the ball from midnight to 1 a.m. at 10-minute increments. At midnight, your moves are pre-programmed. Your moves to avoid being in the same room with death. The board is a circle. It's divided up into, I think, like 6 or 8 wedges. And you move clockwise or counterclockwise. But at midnight, you've got to have it all programmed so you move automatically and keep avoiding death. All those cards you're collecting through the night, you're sort of looking at, what's the rumor? Right. You get a lot of those are going to show you a time and a room where death will not be. But death is going to go to two places every 10 minutes after midnight. So you've got a decent chance of missing death, but like... that one piece of information isn't enough. You've got one safe location, but what if that's not adjacent to, what if both the places adjacent to that are places that'll get you killed?
You're just screwed.
The next move.
Yeah.
So the other thing is you can also look at, like, there's hard information. There's a different kind of card that lets you look at literally for one of those time slots, the exact room that death will actually be in. So you see one of the two. You can't write anything down.
Oh,
it's all in your head. So what's going to happen is at around 12, so at around like turn 11, which is like 11 p.m., people
How
are starting
long is that
to,
into your actual gameplay time?
So like it an moves hour pretty in? Briskly, okay. But there's like 10 turns of setup, and okay. then things unfold in this programmatic sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it moves very briskly, because literally everyone just plays their card for that turn. You take your actions. Some cards let you, like if you're in the same room with other characters, steal rumor cards from their hand, sure. So you assemble more information. But at 11 p.m., people are starting to like converge on the locations they've decided are safe.
Right.
And at that point, you have all these different times and rooms floating around in your head. And the really nightmarish thing is, at least how my brain works, I will associate a time and a room. I'll remember that. Will I remember why I remember that? Like, so I know at 11:30, like, I know at 1:30, at 12:30, there was a reason I was thinking I have 12:30 and the, you know, the red room is in my head. Is that because I know for a fact death is going to be there? Or is that because I know for a fact death will not be there?
Right.
And it's just that at the end of the game. And everyone is going through the same mental gymnastics. And so, like, it's just this kind of fun, like, memory test at the end. Like, you remove your program. You show your program moves. And death begins to move through the floor. And people do a good job with the opening moves. But
sure. Bit by bit.
Yeah. Like, people just, like, oh, turns out, no, you remember that room because that was a death room. Sorry. Yeah. And, like, so people, like, sort of swan into death's path. It's a lot of fun. It's got a cool little design. There's lots of little fun Edgar Allan Poe quote on the cards. There's Poe quotes on the cards. And there's also a cool little, like, clock that advances through Ooh, the night. Like, a little
I love
clock
clocks.
Tower.
Please let me have more clocks.
Yeah,
in my games.
Your turn counter is like this like giant clock tower that you advance the hand of time. It's really cool. It's a lot of fun. I think if you have a good memory, or you have a friend of yours has like a really good memory, that will win the game, right? Like whoever remembers best, you know, is going to win. Although my partner actually cleaned up just by going maximum, just see all the cards and like assemble as many as possible.
All the rumors.
Yeah, she brute forced it.
Cool. Well,
it was cool.
That's it. Seems like so. Did she win? Did she survive?
Yeah.
Damn. Yeah.
Very nice.
Well, congrats. Doesn't she? Isn't she like a doctor? Doesn't she like know science?
She does indeed.
That makes sense. It turns out it's the elite. It's the academic elite who will survive the plague. We're still fucked
down here.
All right, let's take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about some games we've been playing, and then answer some question bucket questions. BRB.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
We are back, and I need to know, Patrick, have you stuck with the messenger?
I have.
Did you get to the part game? That's good?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm like 8 hours into to the game now. I'm deep into the turn there's two turns, I guess, the game takes.
They're rapid. You know, they're not rapid. They're anything but rapid. But
no, once this game needs to lap off like the first 3 hours. The Ninja Gaiden part of it is takes way too long to turn into the 8-bit, 16-bit. Like, the game is pitched on like this. Or at least, you know, it's whenever I've heard about this game, people talked about this game, it's like, hey, you're going to jump between 18-bit and 16-bit timelines, and it's a little Metroid-y. And I was like, cool, that sounds
awesome.
Great.
Yeah.
And then that doesn't happen for like 3 hours into the game, and it's just like a really good Ninja Gaiden game, but one that doesn't have a lot of mechanics and isn't particularly difficult and has like three enemies for you to fight. And I kept going, what is, why... what am I? This is fine, but like it's around like 3 or 4 hours in when like all that stuff turns on, and now it's tremendous, and I'm really enjoying it. But I think they took way. If you either had to keep that all a secret, and that was going to be a big reveal for the player, like, and everyone who played the game, yeah, were like, it, when you were recommending the game to people, you'd be like, there is a thing in this game.
You will
when
not
it happens,
believe it. Yeah,
you
yeah
are going to go, holy shit. They chose not to do that because it was the right thing. Like, it was probably right better to show that that was like a central part of the game. But then what they should have done was like get to that a lot faster, or at least give you a flavor of it. Or like, it's just excruciatingly long, where someone that doesn't have a lot of reverence for the Ninja Gaiden games, like they're I have respect for them and what they did, but I didn't play them growing up. And so just playing one of those without any real twists or turns to it just didn't do anything yeah for me. And I was getting bored, and I was just like wondering, it's got to be right around the corner, right? And then it was always around like six more corners. But now that I'm into it, I'm having a lot of fun doing the thing. Even though I've played a bunch of Metroid-style games
this
summer.
Yeah.
But this one has the right, it's enough twists on the formula that it feels, it doesn't feel like it's hanging its entire hat on going around a map and unlocking abilities. It has a lot of other things that are interesting about, like, just controlling it feels really, really good. It is a tremendous game to control, and so that part of it is, like, always a joy to kind of, like, float, grab,
yeah,
jump. Like, there's just so many, the moment-to-moment, even going through screens that I've been through a dozen times, the game could use a lot more fast travel. Mm-hmm. There are often instances where I'm having to needlessly go through, like, 20 screens for no good reason, other than maybe I've discovered I've forgotten that, oh, right, I still can't do this part yet, sort of
right,
thing.
Right.
But
it took me a while
I
to
really
remember
like
in the second half that if you go to the store, you can go back to the tower and get yourself, you can kind of cut through via
yep
that. And that saved me some time, but it took me way too long to remember that. There, even, you know, on the design side, the first thing you get is this cloud step, which is such a smart elevation or kind of different version of a double jump, mm-hmm, or like a head bop jump, where if you jump, you jump and you land. And if you jump and you hit something, you get a little cloud underneath your feet,
right,
and then you can jump again. It gives you a second jump. And you can chain those together indefinitely, but it isn't just I hit a thing and it makes me jump again. And it isn't just you get a double jump. So you're always very active, and you can get those.
And you can stack it.
Yes.
So once you get like that, and then you also get the grappling hook,
yep,
and then you're climbing on walls. Like, there's just so many
cool
fun movement tools that you have at your disposal where it just takes too long for the game to give you all of that stuff. 100%. And then when you chain that with the way, if people aren't familiar, the way you're going between 18-bit and 16-bit visuals is like there's like these little portals that are scattered throughout the world, and they're kind of sort of marked on a map where, like, if you enter an area, you'll know that there is a portal in that spot, and then the way you'll, like, how you enter and traverse through those is important, right? So, like,
right,
there'll be sections that you could only get through in a certain timeline, and so it coming in right to left, whether you're coming into the area as 18-bit or 16, like, there's just all these really interesting wrinkles that it made me really frustrated how long it took to get there. But once I was there, I've been enthralled by it. It's been my go-to sitting around watching a football game that I'm mostly watching for fantasy. The Messenger is good. And especially given all the games like it this year, like, I punted on Guacamelee 2 because I just have played too much
right
of that, and I don't really miss that I'm probably going to end up skipping it. Even if you, like me, have felt some exhaustion, this game is still worth seeking out. And it is so, you know, we are Switch fanboys here at Waypoint, but, like, this is one of many games that benefits from the platform
yeah
and the portability
right
in a way that is great.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I want to find time to finish it, even though I'm not a big action platformer person. I have really enjoyed my time with it. I still think some of the writing is off. You know, there was that transphobic joke in the beginning of it that they've since pulled out, which I'm happy that they did that.
Yeah,
but right thing to do.
But I do think that, like, that the fact that it was another, did you just assume my, it wasn't assume my gender, it was did you just assume my pun or something.
It was something like that, yeah.
Like that, and I'm glad that
the writing of that game is try hard.
Yes,
it is very, there's writing something that happens to be humorous,
yeah,
and then there's writing things because you want it to be humorous, and there's a fine line between those things, and certain writers can pull it off,
yep,
and they clearly wanted this game to have a certain tone and a certain, like, writing style.
Right,
and
it's a game that has,
it gets, like, it gets them into trouble. Like, for every, like, I would say, like, one in, like, for, there's an ongoing bit where, like, the most amount of the, motherfucker, I just got a review code for that Capcom beat 'em up bundle.
Oh, good.
Wow. Good. They heard you.
Hold on.
They heard
They're
you.
They're listening.
They're listening right now,
they're
Patrick.
They're in the room.
I know. And, sorry, it's I'm distracted. I gotta go punch in this code right now.
Yeah, right away.
You gotta get it.
For every, like, one story that made me chuckle, five made me roll my eyes. And there is some genuinely funny writing in this game.
Yep.
But they probably should have done was just, like, pulled back on a lot of it, or brought other people in to punch it up. I don't know the process. Maybe they did do that. I don't know. But I do know that it just feels like they were trying too hard. And trying too hard to be funny is one of the easiest ways. You see how they would run into that trap where they make a joke like that, right?
It's
like you're looking for jokes. You're looking in the wrong places. You're pulling from the wrong sources because you're trying so desperately to hit a certain style. Like, it's not an excuse. I just see how it happened.
Well, I think
it
also
came out of a place of trying too hard.
It's indicative of, like, 2011 era internet humor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that. There's lots of, like, oh, I'm just being referential. John Metroid gave me this ability or whatever bullshit, right?
Right, yes.
And, like, it gets dragged. I think there's overall some really cool narrative beats. Like, I actually think inside of the format of a retro action platformer, there are some things in there that totally work, but those things tend not to be the comedic bits and do tend to be the just, like, oh, here's the plot, you know?
Yeah. Wider stuff, yeah.
I think I'm glad they listened to the feedback and pulled that joke.
That's the way to do that, is to realize,
sorry,
hey, we fucked up.
Say you fucked up, fix
and
it.
Take it out.
Yep. I've been playing, I beat Frozen Synapse 2, a game that we did a stream of a little while ago. I was playing Valkyria Chronicles 4, which is still good. I'm still playing it. I'm still like 28, 30 hours in there. And around 28, I was like, I should take a break from Valkyria, do a nice little smaller tactics game that I know I have on my back, you know, on the shelf. And play through Frozen Synapse 2, thinking that it would take me 15 hours. Because the first game was kind of it is a same time tactics game, which means that you and your opponent both put in your moves and then you hit go, right? You go like, we're going to go at the same time. Like, you're going to move your troops here, I'm going to move my troops here, they're going to aim, and the dice will roll, or the rules will go into effect, and we'll see who wins that fight. It is a cyberpunk game, so I was like, I'm excited about this. The first one was a collection, it was primarily a multiplayer game, but it did have a campaign, and that campaign was a collection of designed levels, where you were given a set of characters, a set of, like, character types. You can think about Frozen Synapse being more like chess than, like, Final Fantasy Tactics or Shadowrun or XCOM, in that, like, in XCOM, you have Bill, who is your assault rifle, like, support unit. And you have Jennifer, and she's your... And I don't know why I'm not using our characters, Rob. You have Valravn, who is your ranger, and you have Elena, who is your, like, sneaky sniper, you know, lady who's awesome. I can just name all of our characters. I want to. In Frozen Synapse, it's more like, here's an assault rifle unit, and they're basically the same as every assault rifle unit, and what they do is they shoot and at an average speed, at an average distance, you know, they recognize an enemy at an average time, versus a sniper who's far away, who takes longer to kind of clock the enemy and zoom in and get the kill, right? But shoots from really far away, and blah, 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 blah. Frozen Synapse 2 is that, but in a big open, like, world, kind of a strategic map, where you're seeing this city, and you are running a bureau of investigation that is tracking this thing called Sonata, which is a shape form, I think that they're called shape forms. It's like a super AI. This is a world filled with super AI. In fact, a world built with super AI as partners. Like, literally, the actual streets have been made, and the buildings were collaboratively made with these AI that were put into place to help rebuild the city after this catastrophe. There's a lot of ambiguity in the fiction, which is really great, around the, like, all right, wait, did this stuff just kind of phase into being? Is the world around us half digital? Like, there's a lot of
the
weird,
metaphysics of this universe are really fascinating. Like, whatever the catastrophe is, in the process of creating these super AIs and rebuilding their reality, partly in conjunction with these AIs, it's almost like the world now other dimensions do exist. It's where the AIs dwell. But there's also this feeling that those who live in the city also inhabit this liminal zone between the digital space and the real.
They refer to it as the last real city. But like, they also refer to other places. And there are moments where like, oh yeah, you've been in other theaters of war and you've been to other places. But this is somehow the real city because it is this liminal space between the purely digital world of these super AI and the kind of like mud and guts of regular humans. Hmm. I mean, in fact, the troops that you use are shape forms or are vat forms, which are bodies that have basically been printed out of these giant vats, and that you can reprint indefinitely. So if your assault, if Bill the assault rifle guy dies, you just print yourself a new Bill.
Bill two.
And if you, and the way this game works is that there is like a set of services you can buy, so that like, oh, if you want Bill two faster, if he's died and you want a faster Bill two, get yourself a better vat to print yourself a better vat vat body quicker. Or maybe you want to invest in silencers so that when you go into a mission and don't want to be seen as quickly or have a response time as quick, you have silencers on your guns. Or you can spend that money to get better political agents so that you're able to get better relationships with your opponents more quickly. In any case, I thought that game was going to take me 15 hours because the first game took me about that long. It took me like 40. To be fair, 40 was like 1.25 campaigns. So I'd say the full campaign was probably something like 32 hours. And the point of the campaign is you're investigating this super AI called Sonata, which is attacking various places in the city. Those missions are still handcrafted, or at least the proc gen that's decided. The whole city is procedurally generated. Okay. Each intersection is procedurally generated. Each building is procedurally generated, and you can go to any of them and have gunfights in any of them. You can have encounters with other rival corporations anywhere. You're a governmental agent, or you're kind of an independently created agency that is funded by everybody in the city. Safeguard, the PMC group, is paying you money, but so is DeNovis, like one of the upscale neighborhoods that has like the university in it. The university is paying you money. And as you do things in the city, they can all cut your funding, or you can invest in them and get dividends when they succeed at various things. So it's immediately a very murky place. The levels, like I was saying, unlike the rest of it, they're proc gen, but they're proc gen with like very tight constraints, right? So it's like, okay, this is basically, you can imagine a speaking venue is going to be a big open boxy room with like a backstage area and then like a front courtyard where people can mingle or something. And like, it might generate that infinite number of ways, but it's still basically going to be a big rectangle, right?
Sure.
And so there's a bunch of those missions, and there's also the sort of like inner factional politicking, because the goal is for everybody to get these relics, which are special magic power things. You don't know what they are at the beginning of the game. You kind of get a sign of what they are by the end, that are able to give people more power and more control over the shape, over the kind of the area. It means that people around you will like you more. You'll get like militia people, just like regular citizens will show up to have your back if you have the area under your control. At the beginning of the game, they just start coming in and you know where they are. And so your job is to go get them. That's what your bureau is there for. But after the third one or second or third one, the security in your kind of IT breaks down, or your InfoSec breaks down, and everyone starts being able to track these incursions where these relics appear and where Sonata shows up to try to get them. And so everybody starts going for them. The PMCs go for them. The university wants them. The anarchist collective wants them. The bankers want them. Everybody wants them and starts sending their own little like hit squads after them. And one of the most fascinating things for me about this game is the way that stuff is happening on one hand, while at the other hand, so you're competing in that land, but in the main story, you're also cooperating. But in the main story, that cooperation is also always framed as being sort of, you know, double-sided, or being kind of a little bit they're shaking your hands with their left hands. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you don't know what they're actually going to do. And those two things interact in a really fascinating way. And that brings me to like the thing that we recorded. Rob and I recorded a thing and lost it
because
OBS betrayed me. OBS and Discord. Discord
in the middle of the night.
At like 10 p.m. I messaged Rob. At 9:30. I was like, you up? I sent the most like white boy text. I'm just like, hey, you up? Because I want to talk about tactics.
Yeah.
You want to talk about tactics for me for a while? You want to see this mission in Frozen? You want to see this 48-turn mission in Frozen Synapse that took me 3 hours? I hit a point in the main story where, narratively speaking, the head of this group called Safeguard was getting jumpy. My group was very much in the, like, we need to figure out what Sonata is so we can know what steps to take. It's doing some shit that's wild. The guy from Safeguard was like, no, fuck that. We need to kill it. It's hurting people. Kill it. Like, that's what you do.
Gotta kill it.
Gotta kill it. And I was like, you know what? Fuck this guy. And I knew from a previous game that at every HQ, at every faction HQ, because it's a full city, there are a bunch of troops because, you know, you've got to defend your home. There's any relics you've taken. There's all of your stocks and bonds that are represented as physical objects that could be stolen from you. And there's you. There's the player character is in your HQ.
Huh.
And so is the head of each of these other factions, carefully guarded. In this case, maybe not so carefully guarded, as Rob found out. Because I was like, fuck this guy. I'm just going to go kill him. I'm curious if the story will adjust based on if I kill him or not. Because in the story, he's just giving me lip. He's just like, no, get in there and kill. I don't even know what if I kill you and then I don't have to deal with you. Very cyberpunk response to make.
Very good.
And so I end up going on this 48-turn mission. Most of the missions in this game are like 8 to 12 turns, maybe 20. This one's 48. Whew. As it was just storming the Bastille. Like, it was just like a fight in the streets in front of this huge facility. Rob, do you have any characterization here?
The entire...
We watched it. I played the whole thing out for Rob. Oh, I showed him the entire replay, basically. And then we lost it, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean...
A guy named OBS, the assassin.
You completely screwed us. Yeah, I mean, the entire, like, it was like they were holding, like, a warehouse and office facility at the end of a long causeway, basically. So your assault team had to dismount probably 150 yards away from the actual headquarters.
Yeah.
And start just moving up this exposed road with some concrete dividers on it while the enemy's entire, like, guard company, basically.
It's like 38, 40 people.
Yeah. It was like Austin's, like, got a squad and, like, multiple platoons start boiling out of this building.
It's like 6-on-30 or something.
Oh my
ridiculous.
Gosh.
Right. And they just, like, open up. Oh, and there's civilians everywhere as this all hell breaks loose.
Which is one of the most powerful things about this game. I think you and I both noted it in that video that we lost, is the gunfire in this game is so scary. Like, partly because civilians are running around and are very nervous and scared and like, ah, they're not yelling, ah, but they're just like, everything in this game is rendered in a very minimalist style. It's like blue. Yeah, please. It's like lots of blues and blacks with your characters being kind of shining blue, flat textured kind of silhouettes, and the enemies being red and civilians being yellow. And the animation is so, like, simple but very expressive. Those people who are running around are very scared. And it introduces ambiguity in some key ways that produce an effect of there's something scarier to me about getting into a gunfight in Frozen Synapse than in XCOM. In XCOM, I see it says 90% to hit. I know it's a 90% chance to hit. I know it's XCOM, so really it's a 70% chance to hit. But it feels like, okay, am I going to hit the shot or not? I don't know. In Frozen Synapse, when two characters on the field clock each other, when they're like, oh shit, there's a person, they both, like, line up, take their step, and start to fire. And the bullets miss for the beginning parts of that encounter. And there's a chance that, like, at any moment, there's, like, a rule set being calculated. Like, are you standing still? Are you aiming? Are you behind cover? And it's running all those numbers, but it's representing that through just the exchange of bullets, of very loud bullets. Huh. And it's really scary. So you have your characters walk down the street and just open fire.
Well, and there's an element of, like, the contrast, the dynamic range of the visuals. Like, when all hell breaks loose, the general cool, muted colors of Frozen Synapse begin to, like, there's these blossoms of, like, like, muzzle flashes and weapon impacts and detonations. And so, like, the outlines of the level, characters start vanishing into just hails of gunfire. And then as that begins to fade, darker hued, like, corpses are left behind. Right. Like, once people go down, like, they're still, the infrared satellite cam still catches them, but, like, they're dead. Like, they're rapidly cooling. And so it all happens very quickly and decisively. Like, they're fast, brutal gunfights. And the casualties mount really, really fast, and they are significant. And during this assault, though, it got really hairy because you're trying to basically close on this facility that you're not quite – it did not seem like you were kitted out to actually take on. They had, like, literally, like, two guys with rocket launchers start firing down the causeway at you out of the buildings.
Just in ways to destroy cover so I can't sneak. They have, like – the basic thing is they have, like, a bunch of gunners, shotgunners and riflemen and stuff kind of guarding their main entrance. Picture like a north, south, east, west map in your head. The facility is northeast. Far east, they have one sniper watching this whole long causeway. I'm just out of that sniper's range. And they have rocket people to the north shooting south to destroy the little bits of cover that I could theoretically be walking behind to approach that sniper. And the fact that the AI was like, no, I have to destroy that cover so that you can't sneak up on the sniper is like, fuck, like I'm actually dealing with an AI that understands how I'm going to play this game, which is so not the thing that happens in tactics games and strategy games so often.
And there's this one wild moment, too, where they're firing rockets. First of all, they found this weird angle. They're firing rockets through a series of, like, they're basically firing it into one door of a building and out the other. They found this narrow, avenue where, like, they're firing, they're not exposed. So they're firing these rockets, but Austin is also panic firing with a grenade launcher. And so he's got somebody out there with, like, one of those rotary grenade launchers, just like, thunk, thunk.
Yeah.
And one of the grenades bounces into this building, which still has their dudes, like, in it as well. There's other dudes, there's friendlies. The rockets come sailing in. They're passing by just as the grenade goes. The rockets detonate in as sympathetic explosions in midair. That entire building gets, like, fucking cleared. Like, it's like eight people gone, like, in the blink of an eye.
All of this ends up being this remarkable siege of this facility that I chose to do because this is an open world thing. This wasn't a mission given to me. It procedurally generated this really interesting complex. It ends with this remarkable moment where I have my, like, the final little area staked out with, like, peep gunners at the various windows. I open all the doors at once and open up and kind of hack in to bring it out of lockdown. And then just, like, the leader of this rival faction is literally in the front lobby, just standing by himself. And I just have a scoped rifle guy be like, pop, and he's dead. And he's dead. And so I guess I'm going to spoil this mechanic here. Because it is fascinating to me. Skip ahead a minute or two if you don't want to hear this one mechanical spoiler. Because the whole thing for me was like, I wonder what it does. That was kind of my question. I was like, I wonder if it does something if I kill the leader of this faction. Does the story reflect it? And it ended up giving me an option. And again, I'm giving you space to stop or skip ahead.
Yep.
The option was either kill him and kind of give up on the investigation. Decide I don't need him for the investigation, actually. I don't need the investigation at all. I'm going to take over the city by getting all the relics and spreading my influence everywhere. Or send him into exile and hiding where he's still able to operate in story missions for me as like an advisor or whatever, but not actually participate on the map. And I ended up doing that so that I could finish the main story. I wanted to see where the story was going. But it was amazing because there was this moment – it was the moment that – the system of strategy layer plus tactical layer really worked because he'd been the thing I kind of left off at the beginning is like not only was he being an asshole in the story, he was kicking my ass in the streets. He was like beating me to relics.
And just real
he
quick,
had all these troops. Yeah,
this happens as far as I understand. Like because you told me about this, and I think it's a cool detail. This is all happening like procedurally in the city. Like it's not like you get a mission where like they're coming after you. It's like hit teams is on their way to a relic site and they hit a checkpoint.
Or ambush. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And like you're just plunged into it's at this cross street that you've driven past a million times before today. Right. Raging gun battle.
Right. Exactly. And like it's in his territory, so he's able to set up his troops in a better way, and all that stuff is like so fascinating. I will say that I think the game is a little longer than it needs to be. Once I removed him from, an interesting arc happened, which is I removed him from power, or I got him out of there, which meant I could become like the new superpower. And I kept thinking to myself, all right, I'm nearing the end of this game. And so I very quickly let the other factions off the hook. And so a relic would show up and I'd be like, I don't need to go deal with that one. I'll have a story mission in 2 more minutes. I'll just focus on the story missions. And bit by bit, 2 other factions ended up with 6 of the 7 relics they need to force a win for their game. And so the end of that game was me becoming that dude and being the person who, like, all right, I have 4 or 5 or 6 squads now. I just have them rotating around the city, waiting for other groups to win fights, steal the take the relic, and then catching them on the way home when they were down to, like, one guy with an SMG. You're not passing here. Give me the relic. And if they wouldn't, I'd kill them. And so I ended up becoming like the monster.
You're like
rogue
cops or something.
100%.
Oh my god!
Listen, they can't. They're not allowed to have those relics. They'll turn it into
the money train, baby.
That's the wild thing. Is like these are factions. It was like the anarchist faction who I was sympathetic to, but I was like, listen, I just need to complete the story missions. Just let me complete the story missions, and you can have all the relics you want, but you need to give me time. And they would not give me time. I think by the end of that game, some of the veneer comes off of the strategy layer stuff. I think some of it becomes like a little too – you see the seams of the systems. You get repeat dialogue when you call people up to the other faction leaders to gossip. I don't know that there's enough in it to make me step out of my comfort zone tactically. I was like very key to use a very similar team most of the time. I was experimenting for fun, not because the missions forced me to. I didn't dig deep into the multiplayer, but the multiplayer does have one really cool new thing, which is a one-turn multiplayer where it's like, all right, here's an objective. Program a turn in, we'll and run it against a player. And that's a fun little light way to play the multiplayer in what is otherwise a very stressful game.
To me, I still I remember when I first saw this at PAX East a couple years ago. You and I met.
We saw it. It was before we worked. It was our first time we'd actually ever met.
Yeah, we actually met seeing Frozen Synapse. Aww. Yeah, it was sweet. Yeah.
We'd known each other on the internet
for
years.
That's why you could feel comfortable doing the U up.
Right, exactly.
Later on. You knew each other well at this point.
Yes.
And then, I got that text from Austin. I was like, hey, honey, you want to go to bed early tonight?
We should play some Frozen Synapse. Yeah. Actually, so stay up.
No, but when I saw them demoing this at PAX East, I was like, well, this looks impossible. There's no way. Yes. Go with God. Good luck, guys. But you realize this game's never going to fucking work, right? Like, I didn't say that, but I was kind of like, what they had made before was a squad tactics game. It was basically like it was real time XCOM in a lot of ways. Like, that's what they'd made, and here it was this whole procedural city with a strategic layer. I was like, that's going to crash and burn.
Yep.
It doesn't. And, like, it actually sounds like, yeah, you see the seams. You also put 40 hours in, and you're like, I see seams, not, like, walls collapsing. And
right.
Like,
that's really what it is. Like, except for the walls where I shoot rockets. Those walls do collapse.
Oh, yeah.
I think that there's stuff that I wish this game had. At some point during development, they teased having more unique things for individual characters. I don't give a fuck about my characters in this game. I think that is thematically correct for what this world is. We're like, I don't care about individual units or people. I would love a version of it that did make me care about those things. And there was a version of it. There was an earlier build, I guess, or a teased thing once that was like, oh, this assault rifle unit can ID enemies quicker, or this shotgunner is a little bit faster. And I would love to have that stuff in some version of this game, even if it was an optional checkbox I checked at the beginning of the game or something. There's not enough going on in terms of strategic choices besides the relic stuff. Like, I want to. All the other factions in this game are doing shit like building a hacktivist collective, like server bases, and the weird religious the cult that worships AI is going around and giving public talks or trying to convert people, or they have a bunch of like things that they're doing. And I wish I had those options, but you don't, because you're just playing as the Bureau, who is their whole job is this one thing. I want to have an asymmetric relationship with the. I like having an asymmetric relationship with the rest of the factions. I just wish I could also be one of those other factions and pursue whatever their win goals are, which is not just get the relics. It's also spread the word about the AI or build a, you know, undermine the public safety mechanism so that you become the new public safety mechanism. Whatever those things are, I want to be doing some of those things. There's just not enough of that at all. And I would love the politics and the diplomacy stuff to be stepped up a higher level. I think it's already there and it's neat, but it doesn't really – again, the veneer comes off. What starts as really evocative becomes really rote by those final 5 or 6 hours. But again, that's after 25 hours of it being really, really fun. So – I really like it. I'm going to try to put some of these thoughts down as a review later this week.
Shout outs to Ian Hardingham's soundtrack.
The soundtrack is incredible. Nice. It's incredible, like electronic music with some cool vocals. There's a really great vocal track in it also. It's great.
So, I'm very curious. I'm very curious to see if I might be able to make the transition.
It's such
a unique
thing. But, you should give it a shot. You should give it a shot. But it's such a unique, different style if what you've played are the Mario and Rabbids, but also I guess Into the Breach is also a fairly unique thing in that regard. But it's wild to go from something that is I go, then you go, then I go, then you go,
right,
or something with tiles to something that's just like, I don't know, I'm going to put this guy here and hope that, you know, I'll do the simulation because you can simulate what your enemy is going to do.
Right.
And to see like, okay, well, what happens if they pull their sniper around the corner at this angle? I was like, well, you can test that, but how many angles could they bring the sniper around?
Oh, I'm a fool. By the way, no, it's Paul. It's Paul Kildiff Taylor, who's
okay.
the
Paul
electronic
did the
musician.
Music too?
Yeah.
Paul,
isn't he one of the designers?
Paul's the lead dev on this game also.
Wow.
So shout out to Paul for doing both of those
nice
things.
Nice work.
Awesome. So yeah, it's out on Steam. I think it's only on PC right now. Mac to come, I think. I think it's like $30. So go ahead and give that a look.
I might give that a shot. We'll
totally.
See.
Awesome. We should take a dip in the question bucket really quick if people are up for that. If you have questions.
A little bucket dip. It's not the comment bucket this time. It's the question bucket again.
It's not the comment bucket. Yeah. We're back to the question bucket. Gaming@vice.com is the email address. And I have a couple questions for you from there. This one comes in from Stefan from Sweden, who says, I would like to bring up the general concept of huge games that are just ignored by the journalistic side of things unless something super controversial is happening. Many of those seem to be Blizzard games, but there are others also. And Stefan goes on to name some. Overwatch has 40 million active players. World of Warcraft still has around 4 million daily players. The Sims 4 is one of the most popular games in the world, but it's not like we're doing lots of coverage of it. Pokemon Go has grown by 34% since it first launched, and it launched at very high numbers. Stefan says, my point is, what is it that makes certain games or franchises like Forgotten Continents or Hidden Cities huge areas with devoted players who are just ignored by everyone else? Why isn't anyone reflecting on the fact that 4 million active players still play WoW? Despite the hip gaming press claiming that games are dead for the last 7 years, why is The Sims never mentioned when discussing games, and especially when talking about games that lure in non-gamers? I mean, Minecraft is still around, I mentioned, but The Sims, which basically appeal to the same kinds of people, aren't. Anyway, I hope you get some sense from my ramblings. Great show, great people, love you all, be good and be good at it and all that. Thank you, Stefan. I'm curious, what do you think about these games that kind of, you know, we know in our heads are successful? I think, ironically, Fortnite is the one that has been getting coverage lately. But something like League of Legends, which has millions and millions and millions of players, does not often get mainstream journalistic coverage. Thoughts
on
that?
There's no news peg.
Yeah.
You know, seems like the number one thing, right? If there is that sort of news peg, if there is that controversy, unfortunately, you know, negative stuff or negative, you know, a personality doing some outrageous thing does tend to get attention.
More.
And we sure do live in the attention economy.
Which I think speaks to something underneath that, though, which is like, just because a game has 40 million players actually does not mean that they have 40 million people who want to read about
exactly.
that game on a daily basis, especially from writers who have to cover other things. That's the big one. I know, Rob, you just pointed at me. Do you want to expand on that?
Oh, God, no. I think that is a really important point. Like, the thing is, if you've been playing WoW for, oh, God, has it been 10 years? 12?
Something like that. 12,
it's been quite 11. A few. It's been, like...
2004.
Fuck.
Right?
Oh, my God.
14 years is what it's been.
It has been 14
Time
years.
To go to the Grey Havens. but no, I mean, if you've been in that scene for well over a decade, there is a 0.0% chance I'm going to tell you anything new about that game. Right. Like, I could do a deep dive and like really start attacking League of Legends tomorrow to learn shit. Still wouldn't have any relevant or useful insights or information to share with people who like play that game like incredibly seriously. Like their media needs, their article needs are being serviced elsewhere by people who are sort of experts in that scene, or
often by the community themselves.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, One of the big ones is just the like games that exist like that for a long time become they're fields unto themselves almost, and it is hard for like the general interest games journalist to access interesting information there.
Totally, Patrick. You've been reporting on games for more than half
more
of your
than
life.
14 Too years. Long.
More yeah. than 14 years. Why didn't you write more about World of Warcraft?
Well, I've never played it, so that'd be tough. And actually, I've written about World of Warcraft before. It's just not – I'm not going to tell you if the expansion's any good.
Right.
It's resources, right? Like, it's building on what Rob said. And this is, you know, tangentially related to Danielle's point about the news peg, is that when someone says something outlandish or there is a controversy, that is a sort of focal point where you can come in and explain a thing that is separate, that is decontextualized from the larger thing. And to Rob's point, it's there are, you know, Kotaku essentially pioneered, like Steven Tsutsilo sort of pioneered this whole idea of assigning writers to beats. Yeah. Like when I was at Kotaku, I was asked to come up with a couple of games or game series. Like I was the Souls person. So I was following the communities of Dark Souls and Bloodborne and stuff like that. And I wrote a lot of stories that came out of there. Like that was born out of a personal interest and then an assigned interest where I was told to be a beat reporter for these. You know, Mario Maker is another one. It's like, so The Sims, go to Kotaku yep. specifically. Like, Geeta Jackson is out there
constantly
writing tons of
yep.
really interesting, yep. informed pieces about The Sims. So, you know, does Kotaku write about every subculture? No. And, you know, in fact, they took they experimented with doing a more esports focused site that did a lot of really
incredible
interesting
work,
stories.
Yeah.
But if the push and pull with that stuff is so like, if I go in and write about a controversy out of some community, there's a chance that this push and pull with like business and attention and traffic is that if that's interesting enough that it bursts out into where people not engulfed in that subculture might be interested, that's maybe what draws me into it. And then there's a chance that there's going to be an audience that's going to want to click on that has nothing to do with the original audience that subculture is in amassed in. So like Kotaku's like esports thing, they were trying to build up an audience for themselves, and that is extremely difficult. Building up, some games break through because you know what? Fortnite does clicks, like Fortnite does traffic. And it's not even that at the end of the day you need clicks to get ads to get money. It's you want to write things that people are interested in.
Right.
And like as a writer, selfishly, you want people to read things that you spend your time on. You want people to care about it. And so often that's a certain cross-section of games that are expertise, that you have resources for, and that it is proven that the audience of your website will want to read about. And so, you know, that is kind of – was Fortnite for a little while. You can definitely see it drifting.
Yeah.
Like Fortnite is not nearly written about to the same degree that it was before. It's now just part of a pool that people pull out of. But if there were a million other writers who were well-paid and could be tasked with it, they would find those stories. And they're just – you know.
And the other thing here –
that's a huge problem.
That you hit on a little bit is like the answer of why aren't people doing it might actually be they are – you just might not know where that is, right? Like PC Gamer has run 7 stories on WoW in the last 7 days. And those range from WoW's game director is on Reddit addressing concerns about Battle for Azeroth's biggest problems, which is like, hey, slight controversy, negative feedback, here's how they're responding, to in defense of World of Warcraft's worst area, to an ode to Scarlet Monastery, one of WoW's most beloved dungeons. So like, see?
Oh,
so,
there it is.
So, to how this WoW millionaire's laziness made him Azeroth's most famous financial guru. Like, there's a range here of cultural stories, of critical stories, of stories about the state of the game today. That work is being done. It might just be that the people who you like hearing talk like us or like other podcasts you listen to, like your favorite streamers, are interested in other games and in being more generalists.
Yeah.
When you were listing those games, though, that like command huge audiences don't seem to like become a central part of like the game's discourse, though.
Yeah.
Like, there's this other thought I had, which is like, boy, that sure does seem like a list of games that are popular with women and kids.
Oh, like, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. Totally.
And so that's the other aspect of this. It's like, what are the most popular selling books? Probably not the ones romance being discussed novels. Ad infinitum right. uh-huh. on the literary pages in right. newspapers and magazines. So I think there's definitely an element of that often gendered snobbishness that you find across a lot of different media as well. Like, and again, that's the sort of thing that's like, that sort of bias is rarely conscious, but yes. can be pervasive.
Yeah. And The Sims is maybe one of the best examples of that, yeah. where like, I cannot think of a series that has more complexity and kind of critical density for things you could say across Games Crit, across cultural storytelling or about communities. And again, people like Gita have done that work. Janine Hawkins spent years reporting on The Sims. Like, there are people who do that work. But it does not breach into the brainy sphere, so to speak,
yep.
In the same way that even something like Minecraft did. Everyone is looking for that news peg, and there's a deep, terrible cyclicism in this, which is, as an editor at a website, you have to speak to people who have checkbooks. And what they do is they say, sure, you can hire someone new. Sure, you can bring your contractor over into being a full-time role where they get health and benefits. To prove that you can do that or to let you do that, you need to hit X goals. Your OKRs need to be so high or you need to succeed at them. Whatever your metrics are, you need to achieve. And so you have a very material reason to pay close attention to the audience as it is and not the audience as you want them to be. And so that means that for a lot of outlets, including ours, we are having conversations that are like, well, what's the news peg? What's the thing that's going to make someone who would not traditionally look at our content look at our content? Because we have a very material goal in mind, which is we want people to support us so that we can keep doing the stuff that we really, really, really want to do that can be about stuff that wouldn't traditionally get covered in other outlets, right? And so there's always this push and pull. I don't think this is a Waypoint specific thing. Everywhere has material, like very specific budgetary concerns. No one has a blank check, especially not after they launch. You might get a blank check during launch, or you might get a very specific, very big number during a launch. But then the reality set in, and you got to hit your quotas. You have to hit those numbers. And you can. There are ways to shift that bit by bit. And I definitely think, you know, I sat in a room 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, beginning of 2016, with Joel and with my boss now and with the EIC of Vice. And they posed the question to me, which is like, well, what if there just isn't an audience for the sort of content Waypoint makes? And I very foolishly and confidently said, oh, like, we just need to make it fucking cool enough that we create the audience. That the audience that right now sort of cares about this stuff, we need to make it, like, not only acceptable to want to care about this shit, but, like, hip to care about this shit.
Austin, what's your business plan? Let me just give you the speech from the end of Sports Night. Anyone who can't make money off Sports Night shouldn't be in the money-making business.
Rob, where are we going?
Quovadimus, baby.
Quovadimus, where are we going?
Wow.
Don't put me in a room because I'll convince people to do stupid things, like giving me money. But at the same time, what I will say is I think we have seen a shift in a good way over the last few years. I think, again, you look at something like the way Kotaku has broadened out the sort of reporting it does. You look at something like, you know, Polygon, I don't think 2 or 3 years ago would have asked the director of the Division 2 and tried to hold him to whether or not his game was political. I think the conversations through a collection of a lot of great people in Games Crit and in games journalism and the state of the world, let's say, has made a lot of people who previously either didn't have a platform, earn one through their hard work and through people who have been willing to share their platforms, and also people who had platforms, to take a step back and be like, fuck, am I using this right? How can I use this better? And that is not
look at Spider-Man, right?
Totally.
It was like Spider-Man's like
totally.
First wave of reviews was like, you know, and mine included, like, yo, this game's pretty great. And, you know, some allusions to some stuff that was a little eh. And then the next week when the discourse kicks in, which is like, yeah, it was Spider Cop, not just written at one place, not written at an obscure blog that a bunch of people are linking to, be like, yo, this shit's good, right. But it's not at the big place. It's like, no, it's like Kotaku, The Ringer, right. Like lots of, we did a podcast document, something like, there are lots of places that like front of mind, which is like, all right, A. And then B was like, that's amazing, and shows as far as, games crit and like games coverage has to go, it has come an extraordinarily long way in terms of what is thought to be top of mind of what to write about. And so, yeah, it does mean some games fall by the wayside, but I'm glad that I'm willing to, like, you know, if not going to cover League of Legends, leave that to the people who are experts at that. And that, you know, the things that a lot of the people that end up at sites like this are like, they enjoy a game like Spider-Man, but then also want to be like, this part of it's kind of fucked and we should talk about it. And that's the fact that it's been elevated to that platform is really inspiring. It makes me feel good about where things are and where they're going.
You should go look at Heather Alexandra's Spider-Man's take on police fields out of touch over at Kotaku, and at Justin Charity's, I think it's The Spider Cop Problem over at The Ringer.
Mm-hmm.
Both great pieces, conversations that need to be had.
I feel like Youssef did something too that was really good.
Youssef did a piece for us earlier in the year on superheroes.
Right.
And superheroes and kind of fascism. Go read that if you missed that. That was part of our inside the.
That was about the injustice campaign and tying into policing and criminal justice in New York.
Exactly. All right, one more quick one here. This one is from Payne, who says, "Hi, Waypoint. I graduated from college in May, and at the start of August, I got a job with my local paper. Congrats to Payne. While I'd like to write about games someday, having been inspired by work like all of yours, I'm young and I know it's not something most people can break into overnight. In the meantime, or perhaps forever, local news seemed like a good place to be because of the purpose it serves within small communities like mine." Totally agree. "The only problem is that I feel like the critical lens I started to develop in school is languishing without practice. I often get home and don't want to think too hard because, gosh, I'm writing news in 2018. I don't want to lose that skill, though, because I think it's important to have, and one day I'd like to have the opportunity to use it professionally. So I was wondering, do you find folks at Waypoint have any advice on how to maintain or develop the skill of critique for those of us at home? Thank you, Payne."
I have a more general note about having three careers at the same time, which is a thing I do.
Yeah.
Having multiple jobs and having multiple hobbies that take a massive amount of time. And that is to understand that you're going to have a sort of primary focus in your career. You're going to have probably a primary job, a primary thing that brings in the money and pays the bills and so on and so forth. But know that it is not impossible by any means to have multiple things going on and multiple responsibilities. But it does mean you have to be very honest with yourself about how much time goes into those things, because burnout is real and it is my enemy all day, every day. It's something I worry about, something that has absolutely bitten me in the ass at times. So it means you have to be very, very honest with yourself about time management and very, very honest with yourself about what you get out of your passions. I will note this on hopefully an encouraging note. Obviously, people have family responsibilities. They have financial responsibilities. They have a lot of things going on, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you you can do it because I don't know your situation. But it is absolutely possible to do many things in your life, to be a Renaissance person, so or so forth, you know, or however you want to call it, whatever you want to call it, however you want to look at it. And I would encourage you to do that and to keep yourself honest by making it a habit in some way. By writing, it doesn't have to be every day. You pick whatever it is that it needs to be for your life, whatever works for you, and absolutely, you know, stick it to yourself and make yourself do it every now and then. I've probably spent, you know, 3 hours in the last month working on a game I've been working on that is scoped for like a 48-hour game jam kind of thing. But it's going to get done eventually. It's just there's other things going on as well. So you can do it, my friend. just be honest with yourself about it and hold yourself accountable to practice.
Awesome. Rob or Patrick, do you have anything to add to that? Because I don't think I do.
Practically speaking, if like he's just saying like he's like looking for a place to like practice that critical eye, like I have an alternate Reddit account where like I will just go make comments in different places where I want to talk and try and engage with things that I'm like figuring out and like don't want to do on like my Prime account. And like there are endless places to go to like, man, I just want to like work through this argument. And it's like I need a place where I can do that that's not like me doing it on Twitter. And like that's – I like there are endless places – if there are topics you want to talk about, engage with people about them. Like there are places like Reddit or wherever, like a message board. Like there are places for you to engage with people that is different than like putting your public self out there. And like I find that's a way for me to kind of like work through different ideas and engage with people that's like – it doesn't cost anything. There's nothing to lose, especially if you're just doing it on like burner accounts while you're just kind of like playing with ideas. And yeah, like that's a potential like avenue to do that. If you're just like literally looking for like where's a place that I can do this and engage with people, that's an option.
Yeah.
Rob, how about you?
Boy. I mean, this is a really tough thing. I think particularly like it, once you're in the thick of it, it's actually harder to keep that honed and to keep growing because you're in that horrible, like, it's a dangerous cycle of, like, you're playing through everything. Everything you're encountering, you're thinking about, like, what would I say about it? Even if the answer might be you don't have anything to say, but you'll be like, but what could I force myself to say about this? And that's not where great criticism or insight is going to come from. Like, honestly, like, a lot, like, for me, like, a lot of my best pieces catch me a little bit by surprise. They weren't things that I knew consciously, like, I was going to sit down and have a take. Like, every Monday we have a conversation about, like, well, what are we working on? What are we thinking we might get out of something? And for me, even saying, like, well, here's kind of what I'm thinking about writing almost fucks it. Like, almost, like, crashes it on takeoff. Because a lot of times what works best is you'll just be sort of, like, you'll have a thought. You'll put a pin in it, come back to it again and again while you're doing the dishes. And then eventually you're like, wait, I know. And you sit down and you write it. But in terms of like staying honed, like keeping like still encountering like criticism and developing your craft, I think that I would advise you like do not be extremely online. Like the online discourse, the churn of the conversation will have you like chasing a lot of little red herrings. Like there's still a lot of like, yes, you will miss some great work, but it will save you from reading every little thing, every momentary passing thought. When I think what can sometimes better serve you is like keep a well-maintained RSS feed at like Feedly or something where you're like, what are the outlets I really enjoy reading? What's the criticism that I really enjoy pursuing? And like, sit down and mull that over when you have a spare moment. That's one of the things that I try to do is like step away from the churn and try to see like the finished thoughts people are putting out there, the best versions of arguments and critique.
I'm gonna maybe dial it back the other direction, maybe. Though I think the starting point should still be what you said, which is find those finished thoughts, find those blog entries, find those essays, find those columns, and start there. But the thing that kept me honest as a freelancer, where I could – one, I was teaching at the time, so that was not my primary income. So there was easier – I mean, it was nice to have an extra, whatever, $50 here or there. Was the community. It's super easy – to not hold yourself accountable for a hobby. It becomes easier when it's you participating in something with a group. There are people online who love to talk about video games. For me, it was speaking with people like Cameron Kunzelman years ago, you know, when we were both blogging and both in grad school, where he would write an essay and I would write a response to that essay. And then, you know, I talked to Gita about it. And then, you know, or Heather would make a video and I'd watch that video and be like, wow, that video inspired me to write this other thing or, you know, whatever. Like that my cohort, in a sense, you know, games journalism and games criticism weirdly ends up working in this sort of like, oh, who are the new, like, what's the new school of this? The new class. Yeah. And like, that was a big part of my class were folks like that. And so being able to respond to them, to write responses, to know we were all reading the same thing. Today I would be in a Discord with other game crit, people writing games crit. I'd be trying to read things like the Game Studies Study Buddies podcast that Cameron Kunzelman and Michael Lutz put out every couple of weeks is fantastic and like is a great way to engage with people who are working. And like, again, then engaging them on platforms like Twitter and pushing back here or asking here, like stuff like that was so foundational for me keeping that part of my brain sharp when my day job was to be doing media studies, which is a related field but not the same field.
Right. Just a quick question though, because like what you're describing almost sounds more to me like the Brainosphere era, which to me was like very I've completed an essay on my blog and like people would go and back and forth and like read finished work.
That just moved to paste is what happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now, you know, does show up here. It shows up still at paste. It shows up at Kotaku sometimes, like
a lot of
US Gamer, a lot of medium stuff. People haven't stopped publishing Games Crit. Like Critical Distance every week is still filled with writing that I don't have the time to read all of. Yeah. Game Informer runs stuff now. Like that stuff has gotten out into the world because a lot of people, shout outs to Garrett Martin, went through the paste model. Like a lot of people did go through paste. Again, like multiple cohorts have passed through the hallowed
halls.
It's
like the headmaster.
Seriously.
A little bit, yeah.
Seriously. And so I don't think that the spirit of the Brainosphere died in that sense. I mean, it's under threat by way of like quick shot discourse on Twitter and stuff like that. But like people are still having real conversations about games. And for me, being part of those conversations was a huge part of keeping that edge sharp. And finding an outlet.
So. I would say super briefly on all of that would be to also be honest with yourself about what's going to sort of feed you and help you through and help you in the good way of a cohort and not be something that is going to...
Don't get into petty fights.
Exactly. I was going to say pettiness, number one enemy of of this sort of thing, of finding like good community online, petty stuff.
It is so hard to disengage and then one day... It becomes so easy to disengage from people who you know are not actually pushing you to be a better critic.
I think.
Or a human being.
What Daniel was saying there initially, like finding what feeds you, I think is maybe what I was trying to get at. Like if you're too, like if you plugged in and like you're detecting every vibration of the critical web, like it's just tiring. It's too much. Too much noise to signal. But finding like, getting your reading list, getting your habits in a place where you're getting that steady diet of stuff that energizes you, whatever form that takes, that could still be like cool chats on Twitter with good people.
Yeah.
But like find
it. Yeah, whatever form that takes, find what that is. My only real fear of the like get a good RSS feed is that prizes people who have platforms already and who have their work show up on RSS feeds, right? That like I would not have been in your RSS feed 5 years ago. I wouldn't have been. No one knew who the fuck I was until Cameron got me to do a co-written piece with him at Paste. And then thankfully I started building a following from there. I'd been blogging for a while and no one had – who the fuck was following me? And that's certainly true today of people who are writing on Medium, for people who are – or you look at someone like Colin Spacetwinks, who's a great comics critic who primarily functions through Twitter and occasionally does pieces. I shouted out
now Colin's, starting to be on Verve
their Verve column. Or not column, but the piece on Pat Labor. So like that is my only pushback there is there are people in the margins who will not show up there. But I think you're totally right, Rob, that it is about finding whatever that the font of that like thing that keeps you engaged. And you're also certainly right that the discourse can become overwhelming and exhausting as someone who is overwhelmed and exhausted. I get it. All right. I think that's going to do it for us today. You'll note we're not doing waypoints today. That's because on Wednesday, starting this Wednesday, we're spinning waypoints off into its own show. Wednesday waypoints. I don't know if that makes us.
That's
like,
a waypoint.
That's a waypoint. That's
wait.
A waypoint.
I thought we were calling it Rob Zachney's weekly salon.
That's what we're calling it. Rob Zachney will be hosting Rob Zachney's weekly. Sorry, the big dog. Meet the big dog
himself.
On the porch. The big dog's porch. Bring your favorite movies and music and anime.
Bring a bucket of beer.
And a bucket of beer. If you want to talk to the big dog, you got to pay the toll. Ow!
Ow, ow, ow!
That's the intro.
That's it right there.
That's the intro. We got an intro.
You know, so Wednesday waypoints.
Patrick
we'll be talking
is
about,
in agony right
yeah,
now.
Patrick is dying. We are going to talk about a bunch of other stuff.
I know Patrick needed. Woof, 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 woof.
There it is, yeah. he's dying. Good. This week, for instance, we're probably going to talk about Mandy, which I know a couple of us saw. We can't talk about it yet.
Hell
we can't
yeah.
talk about it yet, Patrick. We've talked about it on Wednesday.
Sorry.
Rob, what are you going to talk about?
I think I'm going to talk about propaganda postcards from the
Hell
World
yeah.
Wars.
Oh. Awesome. I'm going to talk about the Dragon Prince.
Ooh, I got some thoughts.
So, you know, shout outs. Full disclosure, Danica does the social media for the Dragon Prince. I've been watching it. I want to talk about it on Wednesday. Yeah. And I think Natalie is going to bring Twin Peaks. It's going to be a rotating cast. Rob is going to be the anchor because Rob is my anchor.
He's all of our
he's
anchor.
All of our
really,
anchor.
He's
it's
the waypoint
true.
Anchor.
He's the waypoint anchor.
True.
It's true.
Lead anchor. Just.
No!
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
It's a sea anchor, Captain. We have to cut the ropes.
No, never.
No.
Never. And so there'll be a rotating cast from week to week. So look forward to that. If you have stuff that you'd like us to check out, you're like, hey, this is a cool article. Hey, this is a cool, I'll be straight up. I think we've caught it. I've said, like, we're taking a lot of inspiration from Match 3 70 times in the last week as I've pitched this internally and externally to various people. So if you enjoyed Patrick Klepek, Geeta Jackson, and Sam Phillips.
Got
yes.
It.
Yeah.
Sam Phillips's Match 3 years ago. I don't think we'll, you know, I it's something to aspire to is what I will say because that show was fantastic.
Which that itself was based on me enjoying a number of Slate
right.
podcasts.
No, we were just talking about Slate podcasts.
I would listen to these.
Fuck you.
Yeah, let's
no, not
stop.
Stop. Don't open me up
we're
on
not,
David
no,
Plotz. I can't do it.
That's an anti-waypoint.
Oh, my God, David
that's
Plotz.
That's a different
but
show.
One of the things that a lot of the Slate podcasts would do, like whether you're listening to their political podcast, their culture podcast, at the end, each of the contributors would like just share something they yeah. were enjoying that was often themed somewhere around like the podcast they were recording or just something interesting in the world. And often some of my favorite conversations were like that little nugget. And so that's what was the inspiration for Match 3. And then, is it kind of being carried on the spiritual successor in Waypoint. So I'm super excited about that.
Awesome. So yeah, can't wait for that to start on Wednesday. And then Friday will continue to be our great kind of designy deep dives into questions like lore.
How do we make good lore?
Puddles.
How do we not do Puddlegate?
What are other rope into the breach?
How do we go into the breach?
Wow. Good question. And you're going to see more from us in the future. I don't want to announce other stuff there yet, both in this feed and in some other feeds. You will continue to see a lot of cool Waypoint podcasts as we move in towards the end of 2018. Speaking of one of those, I guess I can announce the next Waypoint 101 game. We gave it some thought. Well, there are some conditions we wanted to meet. And also we thought it would be good to do something reevaluative. Not either always kind of looking back, but ahead of Red Dead Redemption 2, we thought we should go back to the original Red Dead Revolver. No, we're not doing
Red
Dead
Revolver.
I
yes.
wish we were doing Red Dead Revolver.
Me
kind
too.
Of.
I'm probably going to play it, though. To
yeah.
just to
I've
see
never
what
played
it is,
Red Dead Revolver.
Never
that's
played
the one
yeah,
I've
me,
played.
Either.
I didn't play Redemption yet.
Well, then we're going to talk about Red Dead Redemption.
All
and
right.
it sounds like we're going to do it in two parts.
Probably. Yeah.
I think so. That'll, again, will keep us honest. It's a collaborative collection of people, and they're going to yeah. make us actually.
It's our cohort.
It's our cohort, the Waypoint cohort. We are going to do two episodes of that. I think the first part we're going to play through until.
I think probably up through the end of the major plot line with the character you meet at the beginning, Bonnie. And then it sounded like we all agreed that there's no need to continue past Mexico.
Yeah, there's like there's a really striking musical moment that happens, and basically once you make it to Mexico, we're gonna watch the ending.
If you have time people to can play continue through, to play if yeah, they totally. Want.
Right, yeah. But we're going to sort of just put a marker at the expedition to Mexico.
We agreed about that, by the way, because all of us independently had basically petered out at or right after.
I finished
after.
That game,
yeah.
But it was a rough...
Me too.
Mexico act is a rough act all, right. all the way through.
It's bad.
And if you don't get through it, don't worry about it. So yeah, the first episode will be about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, something like that. And then the next one will be just ahead of the game's launch, I think, in mid-October. Mm-hmm. So we'll have specific dates and a story up on the site sometime this week. But yeah, so that is our next Waypoint 101. Maybe a little predictable, but sometimes it's fun to go back and reevaluate things. Danielle and
sometimes
I...
Sometimes when you've got a smoking gun.
Yeah.
You gotta pick it up and shoot.
Sometimes you got a smoking gun, you got to pick it up and shoot.
That's what they say.
My mama always told me, sometimes when you got a smoking gun, you got to pick it up and shoot. Bang. Shout out as always to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine, waypoint.zone/BOEN for that. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice. Where can people find you, Danielle?
At DanielleRI with a smoking gun.
With a smoking gun. Rob Zachney.
At Rob Zachney.
Partner. And Patrick Klepek.
At Patrick Klepek.
Cowboy.
Cowboy. Thank you. Cowboy Patrick Klepek. I can imagine Patrick Klepek in like a goofy Halloween cowboy outfit so easily.
I can too.
The big hat.
Give my daughter a couple of years, I'm sure.
She'll get
this
you.
This year apparently. Hopefully I don't have to be a king this year. She wants to be a princess.
You should be a king.
Halloween,
King Patrick.
So. King Patrick.
You're a lord.
Lord.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh my
That's
God.
That's true. I
you are
well,
a lord.
Yeah, I'll tell my daughter, no, not a king. I will be a lord.
Lord.
Sorry, sweetie. No
Look
gods
at these
are
documents.
Kings. Not in this household.
Turn off this podcast.
All right, that's going to do
done.
It for us. Thank you as always. Danielle, what do we say to him?
Be good and be good at
Dragon Pig.
Fuck. Dragon Big. He big.
Is he though? I'm being served Big Dog shirts ads.
Good. They know. They know. They see what you need. They know what you need. And what you need is Big Dog shirts.
Big Dogs.
Hold on. I have to look at this one real quick. Big Dog's bucket list.
Oh.
1. Beer. 2. Ice. 3. Beer.
Living that Big Dog life. Ow.
I'm putting this at the end of the podcast.
You know,
I want you to know that.
I was going to bark, but then I thought, that second beer, first beer you bark, second beer,
you howl at the moon.
You howl at the moon. On, bring out the inner, the big wolf, you know?
The big wolf.
The big wolf.
Big wolf.
Oh, I love that movie. All right.
When you're a big dog, but you've been radicalized, you go to Big Wolves.
You go to Big Wolves?
Oh.
Big Dog go on Chapo.
Some big wolf energy.
Oh.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.